Rosington Memoirs. This is an interview of Reynolds C. Rosington made on April 20, 1973, at his home in the Cometa Farm community, Savala County, Texas, by his daughter, Peggy R. Canyon. He discusses events he remembers at Hebronville, Uvalde, Crystal City, Carrizo Springs, and Cometa.
Born in 1908, January the 21st, in Alice, Texas.
What do you remember first about anything?
Well, what I remember first is the Texas Rangers at Hebronville, Texas. I was between 4 and 5 years old, and they were having a lot of trouble with the Mexican desperados stealing cattle and rustling horses and killing people and robbing people, and they called the Texas Rangers in to settle the deal up, to quieten it down. And we used to go down every morning early at this lumber yard where they camped. They had a camp on top of the Henry Eads Lumber Company in Hebronville, Texas. And they came in every morning, and they brought these desperados in, the ones they had killed and wounded ones and things, and the dead ones, and the ones that was part dead, they just built up a big farm, burned them up in the brush pile behind this lumber company when we was kids.
Then you all moved.
The best thing I remember was I was laying there one day, and I was right flat on my back on a bench, and one of these guys was talking about shooting one of these Mexicans and said he bladed like a goat. And I started to laugh, and I had an orange washer in my mouth, and I swallowed it. And they picked me up and rushed me to the doctor like that they were the most tender-hearted people in the world. And when I got over, I didn't know what it was. All I could tell them, it was a little piece of arm with a hole in it. And the doctor told me, well, I said, don't worry about it. He said, this acid will probably eat it up in a week or two. He said, there's no need to worry about that. But they act like they were real excited because I swallowed that arm and washed as cold-blooded as they were.
Oh, then you all moved from there to Uvalde?
We moved from there to Uvalde.
And that's where you...
I believe it was in about 1913.
Well, what did you do when you were kids in Uvalde? Playing?
Well,
how'd you play?
We played in the road, mostly out in the road, and they had wagons. And we'd get out and make little mounds of dirt in the road and sit there and wait for these wagons to come by and mash them down, and we'd build them back and sit there and wait for another to come back. That's all the pastime we had. We didn't have any toys or things like kids have got nowadays.
Had you started to school then when you got to Uvalde?
No.
How old were you?
I was about 5 and a half, I guess.
And you hadn't started to school?
No.
Oh, what about, how old were you when your brother found the money in Uvalde?
Oh, that was years later. That was about 16 or 17, I guess.
And would you tell that about him finding
them? Well, we just kids going down, flying down the street, and he just picked this money sack up laying in front of the post office. It had the sum of $20,000 in it. And it fell out of a buggy. Fellow by the name of John Vatterman, he had gone up in the hill country to buy cattle, but he was a cattle buyer, and he didn't miss it until he got up there. And then when he got up there, he didn't have the bag of money, so he comes back to Uvalde, my dad took it back to the bank, and the sack had the bank name on it. He took it back to the bank, and they said, yeah, he had just got it out of there. So in other words, I guess when he slid out of this buggy, this money sack slid out with him. Couldn't have been laying there very long. So they gave it back to him, and he didn't even give him 50 cents reward for finding it for him. Didn't give him nothing.
What about the first radio?
The first radio that came out in Uvalde, I don't remember exactly what year it was. That must have been about 1917 or 18. And we was coming down the street like kids, you know, just running down the street after school was out. And we saw all these people huddled up in a corner in the street over there. And they had a killing yell every day in Uvalde back in them days. Somebody got killed or somebody shot somebody. And we all sneaked in real easy and sneaked around through people standing there not saying a word. And we got back in where we could see what was going on back in this hardware store, and these people had their heads crammed right up in this radio, and you could just barely hear a little bit of voice coming over this thing. And these people just crammed in that building trying to hear what this radio was talking about.
Was it a crystal set? Is that what it was?
I don't know what a radio was. All I know is they said it was a radio they had to deal up, and they were trying to pick up San Antonio. don't know what kind of crystal said or whether it was a regular radio. We never did get that close, but we could hear a little bit of static and mumbling stuff, and they said it. We asked somebody, and they said they was trying to receive, had a radio set, and they was trying to receive a station someplace on it. And there was hundreds of people down there trying to listen to that blooming thing.
What about the first car that came through you, Val?
Well, the first car that came through the valley, I believe it was, I don't know whether I was visiting my grandmother or we were living there, but I know all the horses, it was tied to these rings in the sidewalks. When this thing went by, it running, just had one cylinder, and it went by, and it was popping like an old beat-up engine of some kind. And all the horses that could break loose, broke loose and run away with buggies and wagons and saddles. They had a regular stampede.
How old were you? About how old were you then?
I mean, I was about 5 years old, but I can remember it real well.
But what about the train? Was the train already in Uvalde?
Uvalde, the Southern Pacific Railroad went through that, but the other railroad was built in 1908, the one that came to Crystal City, came down to SAUNG, they called it, San Antonio, Uvalde, and Gulf.
Did they have any other kind of transportation?
Had a streetcar.
On tracks?
On track. It came from Uvalde down to the north Uvalde to meet the trains that it came in. And the streetcar picked these people up. It just opened. It wasn't enclosed at all. Just a flat car with a motor deal on it. It pulled it down the railroad track. Mm-hmm. And had side rails around it so they couldn't fall off. But train came through twice a day in the Southern Pacific. One going east and one going west. Mm-hmm. And they came back to meet these people. Then they had hacks, buggies that went rolled in down the main part, 2 miles down the main part of town.
What about the shootings? Did you ever see anyone shot?
One man.
Remember who it was?
But a fellow named Neely killed a railroad engineer. I don't know whether he was an engineer or a foreman, but they'd had some trouble. He'd run a cafe. And this railroad man told me he was going to kill him. I don't know what the deal was over. And the little boy run in the house and told his daddy that he had this old jacket wrapped around his hand like railroad men, you know, carry their coat laying over their arm. And he run in the house and told his daddy that man had a gun and he was coming towards the cafe and he shot him. When he came up there and walked past the door, he shot him with a shotgun.
The man's name was Neely.
Neely that he killed. No, the man Neely killed a railroad man.
I don't know what the railroad man's name was. Then how long did you all live in Uvalde before you left?
We lived off and on for, I guess we lived there three different times off and on.
But then you moved
out. We moved down to Crystal Springs in 1915 from Uvalde to Crystal Springs.
Did you see anyone shot or any of the Texas Rangers at Crystal Springs or anything?
No, nobody at Crystal Springs except they had a Mexican deputy sheriff and the Mexicans were smuggling firearms into Mexico in 19. I don't know whether that was 15 or 16, but it's in those teens. Mm-hmm. And they were trying to catch them. They knew they were coming in there and smuggling stuff, but they could never catch them. So somebody came down and told them that they were in an old Mexican shack in Mexican Town in Crystal Springs. They had a Mexican deputy sheriff, and he goes up to this place sneaking around to see what he can see. And one of these guards that they had outside the house stuck his head around the side of the house, and this Mexican deputy sheriff shot him, hit him right in the mouth. Well, he breaks and goes back to town to get away from there. Well, in the meantime, Tom Gardner was sheriff in Crystal Springs, and they had a Texas Ranger there by the name of Frank Buck. And then they got a posse, and they started looking for these Mexicans. They got out in this country between Eagle Pass and Crystal Springs, and Tom Gardner and this Mexican got off to themselves some way, and old man Buck and Tom Gardner got... this Mexican and old man Buck got off to themselves. And these Mexicans captured them. They walked into a posse of them, and they captured them. Well, they put, I think, 250 rounds of pounds of ammunition on each one of them. Made them carry this ammunition. These Mexicans were getting pretty tired. They had loaded down with ammunition and guns. And they came to one of these creeks over here. I don't know whether it's Pendence Creek or Comanche Creek. And they walked off into this creek. And this Mexican, deputy sheriff, he was so tired when he went off down this creek, he couldn't make it up the bank on the other side with this load of ammunition. And old man Buck was a lot bigger man, so he made it up the bank without any trouble. And this one of these Mexicans kept punching this Mexican with his gun, you know, trying to make him get up this bank. And this Mexican turned around and kicked him. And when he did, he killed him. And he's buried over here on this Comanche Creek, about 3 or 4 miles west of Eagle Pass Highway. His grave's still there. And again, his name was Ortiz. I don't know what his first name was. Old man Buck, then they went on, and a fellow named a Camel run into him, and they had this poor old man, and he was just about down, and he rides into him all by himself. And he put the story up to him, if they'll let this Texas Ranger go, that he'll go back, that there was over 100 people back on pasture over on the other side of the hill that was going to, if it didn't turn him loose, they were going to, you know, open fire on him. So he goes in and talks him out of this fella Buck, and there wasn't nobody there but him by himself, but he talks him out of him, gets him to believe in that he's all by himself. In the meantime, when they get him back out of the way, they let him alone. They come on back to Creason Springs. There was about four or five of them left. They come on back into Creason Springs, and the army had came out from Brackenville into Eagle Pass, and they caught him over there. And the guy that was leading this gang of Mexicans, they killed a bunch of them and captured some of them. And it was a white man, the leader. And they put him in, they took him and they tried him and put him in the penitentiary, and Mark Ferguson pardoned him years later. And they gave her a big celebration in Mexico after that part. She was the governor of Texas at the time.
Now, is this when y'all lived on the Bird Farm?
We lived in Creason Springs at that time. Dad was working at Bird Ranch.
And you then moved out there, though?
Then we moved out there.
And you were later. Going to school. And it was how far, and how did you get to school?
Went in a wagon or a buggy or walked. Most of the time we walked, about 6 miles.
And how about the train? Didn't you ride the train?
Well, at times the train, because we went riding and walked right down the railroad track. If the train happened to come along, it didn't have any schedule. Running time, they just went to San Antonio back. When they went and got back, they were back. When they went. And they come along, they'd stop and let us ride. Take us up, top, put us off, just like we belong to them.
And you had said something about that you were the, you went after the ice?
Well, we went on weekend. Well, we'd go in from this big ranch when during harvest time, and we'd go in the wagon and get ice once a week on Saturdays. And we'd go by the bank, and we'd get pick up the payroll, and they'd come out and put it in this ice wagon, and covered up under the wagon sheet that we had the ice covered up. Now, how many dollars it was, I don't know, but there was lots of money involved in the deal. And we never gave it a thought about somebody robbing us. All we thought about was whipping the mules and getting home.
How old were you?
Oh, I'd say 9.
And carried all that
nine
money?
9 and 10 years old.
You and your all brother. Three of your brothers?
No, just one.
One, usually.
And we never gave it a thought about anybody stopping us, taking it away from us.
Did anything else happen while you lived out on the Bird Farms at Winter Haven that...
Oh, nothing. It mattered a whole lot.
And then you moved from there to where?
Moved back to Uvalde.
Yeah. Did you see anything then?
Not too much. It had settled down a bit, a whole lot. That was in
1919.
We moved back to Uvalde.
Well, now, something you said you saw or knew that Alfred Allee, his father, was shot in Crystal City.
Well, he was
what
killed
happened?
In Crystal City, and I think that was in 19. It was in the teens. I can't remember exactly the year.
But we had
just got off the train and started school when that taking place. Right? And they were shooting at Allee from every corner, out of every boxcar and everything else, right in front of this bank in Crystal City right today.
Was he a lawman?
He was a sheriff.
What was his first name? Do you know?
I sure don't.
But it's Texas Ranger Alfred Allee's father. And it killed him.
Well, they shot him down in the... A guy rode up a horseback after they shot him down. He didn't have any more ammunition. He didn't have but 3 shells to start with, and he shot a fellow by the name of Mitchell and Garland Butler and somebody. I don't remember who the other one was, but anyhow, and they were shooting at him out of boxcars from across the railroad track, off of side streets, and then when they... I think Sidney Butler, the butler that shot Sidney Butler and Sidney Butler's cousin, an old man Mitchell. That's the 3 people he shot. He didn't have any more ammunition. But he lived right behind the bank. And his wife heard the shooting, so she runs down there. And Alfred Allee was with his daddy when they killed him.
She runs
down there, and when she turns the corner to there, where this youngest butler boy rode up on horseback, and his daddy wasn't dead, and he told him to get off his horse and get his gun and kill him, and he had shot him, and he was dying, and get off the horse and kill him. He didn't have any more ammunition, and he had crawled in his hallway. He goes up to Dr. Peters' office, and Butler run up there and shot him in his hallway with a 30-30. Miss Allee just got there, just walked up, and Butler shot him with his gun belt and another pistol. She knew that trouble was brewing, and she knew after they started shooting, and she heard the shooting down there, what was going on.
Why? What was the fight over?
Oh, they had a big barbecue down at the Boynton Dam, and they accused him of stealing a cow. Allee, Butler's did. Mitchell and Butler. See, Butler's worked for Mitchell ever as cowhand. And they accused him of stealing this calf and butchering it, barbecuing it, giving a free barbecue off of something that didn't belong to him, you know. And then one thing brought up one word, and one brought up another, and they had a killing over it.
Was this the same bank building at Crystal City?
Same
that's
place.
There now?
Same hall and same place.
Oh, what did you do for some of your medicines back then? What about snake bites?
Snake bites, they use kerosene oil and diesel fuel for snake bites. Just soak them. Get bit on the hand, you just soak it in a bucket of diesel fuel or something for hours at a time.
And it'd be all right.
And I've never seen anybody die from it. My daddy got rattlesnake bit and on Easter Sunday, and he stuck his knee down in a big pan full of coal oil and left it there for about an hour. And if he ever went to bed, I don't remember it. It didn't seem to me like it ever made him sick. But he was bookkeeper out there at Birds, and then Tom Meskin came in there, they was working on the ranch, his rattlesnake bit, they took him up to the pump houses. Stick his hand in these big barrels of diesel fuel, or if it was on his leg, they'd put it in a can. Mm-hmm. And just soak him in diesel fuel for hours at a time. Take him out and he'd get well. They didn't cut him open and lynch him and drive him full of holes. And if they could find some whiskey, they generally gave him a good drink of whiskey to kind of freshen him up a little bit, and that was it.
How old were you when y'all owned your first car or you got to drive a car?
I was about... The first car I ever drove, I was about 7 years old. We bought it out of a barn and went to Chris in it.
From where? Chris?
From Bird Ranch.
Oh, from Bird Ranch.
Drove it down to Chris one weekend, and I drove it. And I was seven. I've been riding around with the Birds, and I knew exactly every pedal to push on to stop it and every one to start it.
Did you have to crank it?
Yeah, we cranked it.
Oh, have you had any experiences with the crank?
Well, a couple of times. Got my arm broke a couple of times of cranking it. And I used to always tell a joke that I got tired of Model T to kick them and break in my arm, so after that they started kicking me. I just held the crank and it just turned the car upside down.
Did you ever?
That's just a joke.
Did you ever turn a Model T or a Model A over or anything?
Oh, I turned a Model T over one time. It just laid over the bar ditch. Broke the windshield out of it. We just got out, set it back up on the wheels, and went on. Didn't hurt it. Just broke the windshield out of it. An old touring car.
Flu epidemic in 1918. Where were you?
We were living in Crazy Springs, going to school in Crazy Springs. We were still living at Bird Ranch, but we were going to school in Crazy Springs.
How bad was it?
It was pretty bad. Just people was dying by the hundreds. They didn't have much they could do for it. So I guess the epidemic was nearly half over. People were dying, and they came out with a salve. That's they called Vicks, Vicks Vapor Rub. And people started using Vicks Vapor Rub, the doctors, and mustard plasters and things, and they finally got the epidemic under control in Crazy Springs. But there was lots of people died in Crazy Springs from it. We was kids. They turned out of school and kept it out of, you know, people getting in touch with it as much as possible, but... It killed a lot of people.
Did anyone in your family have it?
My mother had it, but she didn't die. She never did get over it.
And
she died 10 or 12 years later. But I guess 14 years later.
But never really recovered never from
did.
Symptoms of a cold.
Never did recover from the flu.
Were there any other bad epidemics when you were a child that you remember, like smallpox?
No,
or
I don't.
Like
you know,
that?
I never remember. I don't remember seeing any one person in my life with smallpox.
Were
I thought
you
I
vaccinated?
Did. Yeah, but never did take.
No, I mean all children.
Oh,
people
yeah,
were being
cool,
vaccinated
yeah.
then.
And the only case of smallpox I thought I ever saw, I walked in the house with it years later, and I thought the person had smallpox, so I called. I was working for the Texas Gas Distribution Company, and I walked in the house. And they had this guy wrapped up in sheets, and they said he had chicken pox. And they called us to come out there and work on their gas heaters. It was in the wintertime. And I went right straight back to Mary down at the health department and sent them out there to see if he did have the smallpox. But they came back to the gas office and gave us the clearance that it was a chicken pox. But that was the worst case I ever saw, and I thought it was smallpox. And that's the only person I ever saw that looked to me like he did have smallpox.
Mm-hmm. What about when World War I started? You were how old? You remember any
I don't know how long it lasted.
Or?
It was over 1918, wasn't it?
Was it over 1918?
I don't remember. I remember the day it was over. They turned out of school, and we was going to school in Christmas, and they turned out of school and had a big parade and really had a shindig over it. Blew the train whistles and didn't have any fire sirens to blow, and they rang bells. People loped their old horses and mules up and down the streets. Really had a celebration over it. I don't know. I think it was 1918.
Were there a lot of local boys that went away or not too many?
Oh, I don't imagine. It was over half a dozen. Crazy.
That left from this area.
They had one in Crystal City. It was Gus Ware posted. I know he was the only one that I knew that was killed. He lived in Crystal City.
Did you ever see any shootings in Creaser or Crystal yourself? See any?
No, that alley killing. We saw that alley shootings all the way up.
Oh, you saw the alley shootings. Well, what about lynchings now? Did you ever see anyone lynched? Did you ever see anyone legally hanged?
No.
Never saw anyone legally.
Never had the opportunity. I'd have went, I guess, but I had the opportunity.
Did you ever go and sit in a court trial or anything?
On what?
Anybody up for murder or anything?
No.
You never went to a trial?
I've been on court trying later years after that, but not when I was a kid. The killings was rare. There were lots of killings, but then and I don't think they tried too many people for killings back in my days. I think the best man won that deal. Then we moved from Bird Ranch over to a lake over in the backside of the Bird Ranch country that they called Cometa Settlement. And then we farmed there for a few years, and the house was burglarized and burnt up. They stole what they wanted out of it, a bunch of new guns that we just bought the year before. And so later, that was in the 20s. I don't know whether it was 23 or 22. 23, I guess, or 24. Anyhow, and we put up a tent, and we had a nigger working for us there. And we put up this tent. And in the meantime, when this house burned up, we had a bunch of hog pens in it made out of logs. And these pens burnt about half down before we got them put out, and all the hogs got out. So we put up a tent on this place. Didn't have anything that the hogs could damage. And we just let them run out on the lake. We had a big lake right behind us, about a couple of hundred yards. So one night, they were scared to death anyhow, because this house had been burned up and been burglarized, and they didn't know what to think about the deal. So one night, we was all in this, had up an army tent, and it was real warm in the summertime, had the sides rolled up on it so the air could circulate out of there. And these dogs got after one of these big hogs, and he went through this tent. And he run under this nigger's cot, and he carries this nigger cot and all, this hog does, outside and turned it upside down. And the time everybody got woke up. Well, this nigger was just as white. If you'd have paid him white, he wouldn't have been any whiter. And that was about 2 o'clock in the morning, and he sat up the rest of the night, just built him up a little far outside where he could kind of see him sit there. He wouldn't even go back to bed. He was scared so bad. He just knew somebody was going to kill him, I guess, the way he looked. I don't know. That was the scariest person I believe I ever saw.
What? At this time, wasn't there a Mexican settlement that's not
there's
there
There's a Mexican
anymore?
Settlement over on Titan Creek, a Mexican claim land. And they lived there for years, and what happened to the deal, I don't know, but they just eventually all moved off one at a time or died out one at a time. That was back in the 20s. And King Fisher had a cabin back on Comanche Creek from there.
What about him? What kind of person
And all I know about King Fisher is where he stayed on his trips from Eagle Pass through this country. He had three camping houses. One was made out of rock and adobe, and one was made out of logs, and the other was made out of about half lumber and half logs. One of them was on Comanche Creek, and about 10 miles from that on Pendence Creek, just below where we live right now, he had another one. And then about 5 miles out this side of Eagle Pass, he had another one where he stayed on his trips through this country, and it was made out of rock.
Well, who did he rob?
I don't know. What I hear, he robbed anybody. I don't know. Just what I hear. He was kind of a cattle rustler had his cattle rustlers, and he probably wasn't in the deal himself. But what I hear, he just was a big gangster of some kind, an outlaw.
This was on horseback, too.
This is
right?
A horseback deal.
There are some stories about him working Mexicans, too, and then killing
them. Well, yeah, that's here so, too. He said he'd work them for 6 or 7 months and pay them off and have his men to kill them before they got to the border and bring the money back. Now, that's here, so I don't know whether that's...
When was he operating? What years about?
Oh, gosh, I don't know when he was operating.
Was this...
But he was killed in San Antonio. He got off the train, coming from Austin, and met some guy, and they were walking along the street, and these gangsters in San Antonio was after the man that King Fisher was with. They didn't know King Fisher. And they shot him with a shotgun, and they killed them both. Kingfisher was walking with him. He'd met on a train coming from Austin, and they didn't even know who Kingfisher was. It didn't mean they killed them both anyhow.
He's buried in New Valley,
He was buried in New Valley.
Oh, also there was an outlaw family called the Newtons in New Valley. What do you know about them?
Well, I knew them all my life when I was a kid in New Valley. You know, they lived around there, and their mother bought groceries for my grandma in New Valley, and the Newton brothers robbed a lot of banks that they never was proven to them, but I guess they did it anyhow. Then they robbed the Chicago mail train and on the hold-up deal there, and they got caught. Well, not, it took them several months to find them, but they finally picked them up one at a time, and I don't think any Newton's got a whole lot of sentence out of it. Didn't seem to me like they were in jail very long.
What year was this train robbery?
I believe it was in 24.
And where?
In Chicago.
Oh, they went all that way from Uvalde, but they were from Uvalde. Yeah. What were their first names?
One of them name was Jess, one name was Willis, one of them name was Doc. That was the three that was in the robbery. Then there was one individual named Tully. It didn't seem to be into anything. It seemed like he might have been the bookkeeper for him or the money carrier. But he was an innocent bystander. He never gotten anything in his life that anybody ever proved on him. But the other three was pretty...
Well, did the family have any obvious means of livelihood when they lived in Uvalde? What did the mother and father of this family do when you knew them?
Nothing.
They didn't do anything,
Them boys, it was cowboys and cowpokes and run around and outlawed and all their life. They're all dead now. No, one of them's still alive. The Willis is still alive, lives in Uvalde.
Well, when you lived in this area, Uvalde, Crystal, and Creasy Springs, who were some of the prominent people that lived here then, like in Uvalde, who were the most prominent people living here?
The Kincaids and Garners.
In Uvalde. John Nance Garner?
John Nance Garner. Yeah, him and my dad were in the real estate business together for years up there when I was, him and my mama got married. I never hear him say, but I know I did. He did say something about being in the real estate business with Garner years ago.
And then
the Kincaids, they were big ranchers in Uvalde.
And still own a lot of property.
Still own a lot of property there.
And what about Crystal City at that time?
Crystal City, I don't know whether there was any prominent people in Crystal City or not. It looked to me like everybody in Crystal City was just about as poor as they could get when I was a kid.
Well, who owned the Cross S Ranch at that time? Do you know?
I don't
the family?
Know. I don't have any idea.
But that was the big ranch.
That was
Crystal
the big ranch. Crystal City was developed from now the Cross S Ranch. I don't know who owned it.
And had Grover Jackson's family moved to
Jackson's
Crystal?
Were living in Crystal City. Jackson's and Sparks's and Butler's and
probably what was the first permanent home built in Crystal City or the first permanent building?
Well, as far as I know, the first permanent buildings are still there. That old bank building and that old drugstore building over there, that's two of the oldest buildings in Crystal City. Now, resident sections, I guess Piggies.
What was the family?
They put their mercantile store in 1908. That's the year I was born. It was there when we moved to Crystal City. That was the only store in Crystal City at the time.
Piggies Mercantile, is that what they called
it? Yeah, Piggies Mercantile.
And then later on,
people opened up little old stores and drug stores on corners and things, and this town gradually built up.
Crystal City actually didn't start till the railroad came through, did it?
Well, the railroad started in Uvalde in 1908. Now, how long it took them to build it, I don't know.
But Crystal City was built on the railroad.
We did ride the train from Crystal City to Uvalde in 1911 and 13 when we was little bitty kids. I remember riding the train.
They have a passenger car on the train?
Yeah, a passenger car and a baggage car on the train.
And that's all that was on it, the engine and two cars?
Well, they pull a little, a little freight along with them, a box car or two maybe something. But it took them generally about 5 hours to go 45 miles on that train because they stopped and killed every rattlesnake, every rabbit, everything else that they saw along the railroad track. Even stopped and go rabbit hunting.
No schedule.
No schedules.
And that was about what year that you did that?
In the 18s and the 20s.
Mm-hmm.
Off and on.
What were the crops around here then, the main ones?
The main crop them days was onions. I don't think they knew anything about anything else but onions. I know they started growing spinach in about 19. I'd say in the 22 or 23, the fall of 22 and the spring of 23, that's when they had this big spinach deal.
And when did they start growing cotton in this area?
Well, they growed cotton in La Prairie when we was kids. That was the closest cotton. In the 20s, they started growing here.
Did they irrigate then? And what situation was the water in then?
Situation, the water flowed. They didn't have to pump it.
Just flowing out of the
ground? There were very few pumps in the country at the time all the irrigation did here.
And as far as you know today, there's no flowing water?
Not in this country. Not. I've seen it go from 16 feet above the ground down to about 560 feet east of the Nueces River, the water level is today that it used to flow. And I'll give them 10 more years and it won't be any well water.
Crystal City and Carriza Springs both were named because
of on account of the Crystal City was named on account of the crystal water. Carriza Springs was named on account of the springs that flowed down the Carriza Creek over there.
What that's does Carriza mean in English?
Fishing pole.
Fishing pole.
Carriza Springs, that's a Mexican name. Carriza is fishing pole.
Did you eat any unordinary food when you were child that you don't eat now?
When we was kids, they raised a few strawberries in Carriza just in gardens. Then we eat pitayas that grow wild in the brush at different times of the year. They come out and bloom in the spring and have a pretty purple flower on them, and they make a little round ball about 2 inches in diameter, and they got this little flower dries down on top of it. And then they got little thorns just all over this little skin that's on the outside of this pitaya. And when it gets ripe, you get a hold of this little bud of watered up, dried up leaves that's on top, and just take a hold of it and shake it a little bit, and it'll come off if it's ripe. And then if it's thoroughly matured, them little stickers that's on the side, they'll just fall off. You just rake them off. And then you peel that thing, and it looks just like a strawberry inside, but it's white and got little black seeds in it. It is delicious. We used to make ice cream out of it. We didn't have anything else for ice cream. We'd make ice cream out of those pitaya buds. And it is a delicious fruit. And why somebody hasn't done something about it, about growing them and selling them, I never know.
And I noticed that they're growing in your lane to your house
between
today.
Between here and the road, it's beautiful. And they're just a cactus plant is all they are. But they're delicious. There's nothing, I don't guess it's a fruit. Going, it tastes any better than a pitaya does.
Did you eat much of the prickly pear, or did
no,
you all
No, the prickly
eat
pear never did have any taste. I never did have an appetite for prickly pear. I've seen Mexicans eat it. They peel it off and eat it. When it first blooms out, makes a little bitty leaf, and it's got little bitty thorns on it, and how they get them off, I don't know. But I've tried to rake them off, and I couldn't get them off. But they get them off, and they eat it, and they claim it's good. But they put garlic, and they put eggs, and they put sausage in the thing, and you can take rocks and make soup out of it if you put enough flavoring in it. Have rock soup.
Did you eat mesquite beans?
I've chewed mesquite beans but a handful. I don't know if people said they were wormy, but I never did live to see.
You speak the Mexican language. How did you learn to speak the Mexican language?
Well, when I first started speaking Spanish, I was playing with Mexican kids, and I didn't know one word from quinceañera or crocodile or anything about Spanish, and we played with those kids. We moved to this bird ranch, and I was 7 years old in 1950. And we had no white children to play with out there except the bird kids, and they were off in a different settlement before we lived, and we played with Mexican kids mostly. And we'd get with these Mexican kids, and we'd finally learn and find out what things were, but just talking and asking and pick up a few words here and there, and it finally came in pretty natural to talk Spanish about as easy as you can English if you just get down to it, and if you have to learn anything, well, you can learn it.
And you've worked on farms in this area all your life, so you've used it.
Oh, yeah, real. The only thing I never could learn is to write it. I can write a little of it, but it's odd to me. I never could learn to write it, and I never could learn to read it too well. Of course, I never did just sit down and take a book and stick my head in it, but what I learned is just what the Mexicans told me at the time, what it meant and what it was.
What were your, when you got old enough to hold down a job and everything, what was your daily wage? About how old were you when you had your first, what you'd call, real job?
Well, we farmed for years.
Well, but I mean working for someone else.
Well, the first job that I can remember I ever had in my life, I worked for a man hoeing out an orchard for 50 cents a day. And we worked there about a week. And when we got through, he paid my brother, and he didn't pay me. That was my first job. And that man I still don't like today. He's still living. He's a pretty old man, but I still don't like him because he beat me out of $3 as a kid. It wouldn't make so much difference nowadays if a person beat you out of $3, but when you was a kid, it kind of hurts, you know. And then I went to work for CP&L. We farmed for years. And I went to work for CP&L Light Company and worked there about, I guess, 5 months. Then I went back to farming again. I couldn't see any future in that. And actually, there's no future in farming if you don't have enough money to back yourself up when you lose. And then I went to work, I guess the next job I had, it was on WPA. Farming got so bad you couldn't make a living, you couldn't sell anything you raised. And we still lived on a farm, but we worked on a WPA job. And we got, I believe it was $2 a day. We worked 10 hours, and we got $2 a day for it. And we used a maize scoop, not a shovel, one of these old big maize scoops, and we shoveled caliche dirt on trucks, and they hauled it off of man trucks, and we loaded it by hand, and they unloaded it by hand on WPA job. Then that deal worked, and then during that meantime, I went to work for Texas Gas Distributing Company, and I worked for them about, I guess, 6 years, and then they sold out, and then I went worked for the city of Crystal City for a while, and then I opened up a filling station. That job was just to train somebody they already had working a little bit about the gas work, gas, water heaters and things, how to take care of. And then I went and opened up a filling station of my own, and a guy came along and offered me a job working on a construction company by the name of Mac Morris during World War II. It just started, hadn't quite started. We went to Houston and worked out of Houston, and that was, I guess, the best job I ever had until I fell into something else later on, a year later. But we made it, I guess, as good a money as you could expect to make on a job in those days, working on building airplane hangars and warehouses. Just before the war broke out, we were putting up hangar buildings and warehouses. We built a hangar building in San Antonio, one in Galveston, and a bunch of warehouses in Kelly Air Base in San Antonio. Built a bunch of these NYA schools all over the United States, different places, and then I quit that and came back to Del Rio and went to work for the gas company. The war broke out. Then in the meantime, after the war broke out, I quit the gas company and went back to work for this construction company again. And I worked for them till the things began to level off and the work began to fall off. And then I went to Eagle Pass Airfield. They opened up an airfield in Eagle Pass and went to work over there on the plumbing, for the plumbing department in the Eagle Pass Airfield. And me and a boy named Roy Butler, we installed all the plumbing in the Eagle Pass Airfield. And then when that fell down, got finished, and that job played out, we came to Crystal City. They were building an internment camp in Crystal City to put these aliens in. And they were building these bathhouses and all these houses and putting all these things up for these people.
End of side one.
We're building in Crystal City. We put the plumbing in this internment camp, working on self-service job at that time. It was all self-service. And when we finished this job in the past, they sent us to Crook City on account of having such a good recommendation as plumbers. Why, they sent us to Crook City. And we put all this stuff in, and they began to move these Japanese and German people in there from South America and from California. And most of these Jap people that was picked up in the United States, they were put in there voluntarily. They volunteered to be locked up on account of the people getting so hysterical about their sons and things being killed, they were afraid that they would just be murdered outright. So they asked, most of them asked for voluntary internment. They were rich people. A lot of them were. They were real wealthy people. And they built a swimming pool up there. The Japanese people built a swimming pool, and the Germans on their own. The government furnished the money for the material, but they built it on their own. They furnished the labor and did all the work. And it was one of the most beautiful swimming pools, I guess, that was ever built. And the biggest in this whole South Texas area. And it was started off at about, I guess, I'd say the water was 6 inches deep at the edge. And it tapered down to about half the distance of this tank. This tank covered about, I'd say, an acre and maybe an acre and a quarter of land. It was round. I'd say it was 250 feet in diameter all the way around it. Across it anyway, and it tapered down from 6 inches to 3 feet for the children to bathe in, half of the tank, and it had cables stretched across it where there's no, the kids that couldn't swim wasn't supposed to get over on the deep side. And the deep side, the deepest part of it was about 16 feet deep, and they had swings and diving boards and just anything that they wanted to put up there, it was put up there. And they got things that we couldn't buy, was gift to them, just flat gift to them. We used to go up there and work in there, and we'd be working in these candy trucks, Hershey bar candies and chewing gum wagons that come in there, and they got all this stuff. You couldn't buy it out of this camp. And we'd get those kids, and they'd buy this Hershey bars and this chewing gum, and they'd buy it for us and bring it to us, these Japanese kids and little German kids and whatever, anybody we could get to buy it for us. And those people, my estimation in this internment camp was really, they were real happy. I don't believe I ever saw a person in an internment camp that was locked up in this internment camp up here. And I stayed there from the start to the finish.
Did you ever see anyone mistreated by
Never seen America. Nobody mistreated. And what I could see, everybody was treated right. And they'd do anything in the world for you. You could go in there, they had a furniture shop. We'd buy lumber or we'd get these birch ammunition boxes. It's made out of birch wood. And they made me a little table that's made out of birch wood. The top of it is, which is hard as nearly as metal. And I've still got it. And then they made me a cedar chest. I furnished the lumber for this little cedar chest. And they made me a chest out of lumber. Well, they made me a lot of things and gave to me while I was working. And they were real friendly. It didn't seem like anybody had it in for anybody. They didn't seem to be mad at the world or because they were locked up in there. And then they'd bring them into Crystal by the train loads, and everybody in Crystal City run down there just like they had a bunch of outlaws tied to their posts and watch them unload them.
How did the people in Crystal feel about the camp?
I never heard anybody say too much about what was going on out there.
People weren't afraid?
I don't think people were afraid of them. And they'd unload them and put them in buses and haul them out to this camp about a mile from the railroad track. And I couldn't see anything wrong with the camp, and I couldn't see anything wrong with the treatment. They had things that we didn't have. They had hospitals, I guess as good as they could get anywhere, built in there. And it seemed to me like it. They got all the services and all the doctors that they needed to care there.
Were any of them allowed to leave for any reason?
They worked out. Some of those people were American citizens.
Yes, I know that.
And they worked. They were allowed out to work outside. They worked outside on the farms and different places, but they had to go in a group. They took a guard with them, and they had to go in a group. They took two guards on each truck in order to keep somebody, you know, running these, like these Japanese people that did, people didn't like them or something. Well, in order to protect them, they didn't want to, you know, somebody go out there and just shoot them down.
The people here then were here for their protection.
Oh,
they were
locked up, and the guards they had around this big concentration camp that was watching this fence, they wasn't meaning to just merely watching those people keep them getting out. They were watching people keep them getting in, going in there and killing them. That's what they were asked to be violent. They volunteered to be locked up. These Japs did, the most of them.
As far as you know, what happened to these people when the war was over?
They shipped them back to Germany. All the aliens went back to Germany. All the citizens, I guess they turned loose. The Japs went back, shipped them back to Japan. And I heard, I don't know what this saw, but they traded them for prisoners, war prisoners. I don't know whether that's so or not, but there was some trades made. Of course, you don't know what went on. But as far as being mistreated, I don't think there was everybody mistreated in this internment camp in Crystal City.
Now, you were married in 1933. That was in the Depression. What were you doing during the Depression, and what was your salary every day?
My salary during the Depression wasn't nothing. I walked 3 miles to work right where I'm living right now. A farm is 3 miles across the pasture, and it's 10 miles around the road. And I walked over here, and I had a wife and two babies, and I worked from sun up to when the sun came up, I was here, and I stayed here till the sun went down. I got $1 a day for it, and I walked home. When I got through, I got home after dark. I left before daylight the next morning, and I got $1 a day for it, and I had a car. I couldn't drive my car and come around the road and work for $1 a day. I walked.
But you never received any kind of help in food or anything else?
No, no help.
Bread lines?
We farmed, and they had a relief canner. And we take this stuff in, and they canned it on a 40 and 60% basis. We got 60% of what they canned, and they got 40.
In other words, there was a cannery operating
by the government.
The government operated on the
relief. It was a deal. And you take this stuff in there, and people that didn't have anything to can, and what percent they took of yours, they gave to somebody else. And we'd take turnip greens and spinach and beans, corn and stuff in there, and they'd can it, and we got 60% of it, and it didn't cost you anything except to harvest it. We harvested ourselves.
Did you ever actually go hungry during the Depression?
No, ma'am. No, ma'am. I lived in the country, and I violated the game law. I killed everything I could kill it. I could eat during the Depression. I guarantee you, there wasn't no thing to keep me from eating. I could buy 2 boxes of 22 shells for a quarter, and I made every shot count. There wasn't none of them wasted.
You did own a car in the Depression.
Oh, yeah.
You just didn't run it because
just,
of
just
the...
You just go to town and back in to get what few groceries we bought. Most of it we tried to raise or we killed.
You were 12 miles from town. How often did you go?
On weekends, on Saturdays.
Once a week. Did you... on Saturday, was that kind of a get-together in town?
That was a big day in Crystal City. On Saturday evenings, everybody started getting about 5 o'clock in the evening, and the barbershop stayed open until after midnight.
And they had and the movie. Stores, did they have the movie then?
Had a movie, but we didn't go much. And the barbershops and the stores all stayed open until midnight on Saturday nights. And the town was real lively until after midnight, every Saturday night.
Now, this would be about 1933 and 34.
34 and 35.
Paved?
Yeah, the streets were paved. They streeted the paved in 27.
In Crystal City. Uh-huh. 1927, they paved the streets.
Paved the streets in Crystal City.
Both of those main streets on
the side
of the railroad.
All the streets is paved there now.
Just about.
Yeah, they haven't paved anymore since then. Maybe a poor little oil or something on something around, but they've never done any actual paving to mount anything since then.
And, well, that was until urban renewal. They did a lot of paving.
Well, they have done a lot
years.
Of paving, except in that new those new projects they built. Mm-hmm. They haven't paved any of the old streets. Mm-hmm. These housing projects they built, they put in a little pavement around on them.
Saying that you killed the wild game during the Depression to live, did there seem to be more game then, or is there more now in this area?
I think there's more now than there's ever been. But back in those days, there's more people more or less lived off the game than they do now. You were allowed $3 a year back in those days, and of course they allow them to kill a doe now, which I don't agree with. I don't think that they ought to be allowed at all. I think the does should be left. If you kill the does, you're going to run out of game eventually. But the game department don't seem to think so. But they're not as smart as a lot of people that know. All they know is what they hear and what they other people tell them. They don't know actually. The game department don't actually know anything.
And you say you think there's more game in this area today than
there
was.
Oh yeah, I think there's more game
in the Depression.
Yeah. All they do is game department. They'll sell you a license to hunt, and then they'll take your money that you pay for this license and hire a man to keep you from hunting. That's all they know.
Did you eat rabbit and javeline at that time too?
I've eaten everything from rattlesnake up to javeline.
You ate rattlesnake.
I've eaten some rattlesnake, not a lot. I've tasted of it. It don't taste.
What about
bad.
Armadillo?
Armadillo is a good deal. Armadillo is not a bad meat.
Did you all fish much?
Oh yeah, when we was farming, we didn't have anything else to do, but we kept the water pretty warm fishing.
And you lived pretty close when you were at Cometa, and you're living in the same place now, close to this large natural lake that's called the Comanche Lake.
That's right.
Is this the lake that there's some superstitions about?
Well, I've heard a lot of things. There's been gold buried in there, and there's gold buried here, and there's gold buried there. And all I know is what I hear about this gold business. It's supposed to be a lot of money. Gold bricks buried somewhere between Brundage and Eagle Pass.
By the Spaniards?
By the Indians.
Oh, by the Indians.
Indians killed these people, and when they left San Antonio, they were supposed to have all this gold. And when they killed these people, and then the Indians was captured, they never did find any of this gold.
Do you have any idea what year that was?
No, I don't have any idea.
But people have it, especially Crystal City people, have looked for this gold.
Oh, yeah,
I've
dug a few holes and this and that, but I didn't ever get up enough ambition to dig too many. This guy came in here one time, had one of these money hunting deals, and he was really going to dig it up. And we dug a few holes, but we never dig up any money.
This is sort of on what was part of the old Spanish trail.
The old Spanish
where the Spaniards
trail goes through,
through
this country.
There's a lot of Indian relics and arrowheads in this area.
Oh, yeah. I've got Indian heads, Indian arrowheads. What my kids haven't carried off. I've got a few left.
Pretty early to the Cometa community after it was settled. Can you name some of the original people that moved down here to Cometa?
When we moved to Cometa in 1922, the fall of 22, there was the Van Cleves, old man Dove Van Cleef, and B. Van Cleef, and Willie Van Cleef, three brothers, lived in the northwest corner of the county, kind of, not all the way through, but it was in the corner. And then there was a few farms in the country. One of this big farm at Cometa was Coleman. I don't know what his name was, but it was a Coleman. They cleared all this land up and improved it here. And then the Dunkles moved in here, and I think before the teens.
What was Frank Dunkel Sr.'s father's first name?
I don't know. And the Erskines moved in. The Erskines was here, and one of them was Fred, and one was Luke, and Andrew Erskine.
When did Frank Harris move out?
And the Harrises were here for, when we came, they were still here. Old man Harris was, old man Harris at one time, when I don't know whether he was living in this country, but he was senator or congressman here before, or speaker of the house, maybe. But anyhow, he was in the politics before, either after he moved here or before they moved here. I don't remember.
This would have been...
I think was a senator. I'm not sure. And they got two or three little old cemeteries blocked off around here. Some of them is Erskine Cemetery, and one over here is kind of a community cemetery, the one in front of the Brooke Erskine's house over there. But I've been there a lot of times, but I can't remember any of the people that's buried there. Seems to me like there's a lot of Vivians buried in there. I don't know for sure.
When was Comanche settled? Do you know what year people first came here?
I don't have any idea.
Would it have been before 1850 or not? Think not?
I believe it was in the 1900s or something.
Oh.
It was close to 1900.
It's not much older than Crystal City then.
Just about the same age, I imagine.
1900.
Same as, probably the same, about the same as Crystal City. Eagle Pass was, Crystal Springs is older than Crystal City, and Eagle Pass is older than Crystal
yes.
City. Cthulhu, I think, is older than any of the two of them. I don't know for sure.
Mm-hmm. What about the school up here on the hill that used to sit up here that's not there anymore?
Well, that was just a little old community school out here. They had the hard teacher, and it's pretty hard to find one that would stay out in this country. Most of them wasn't in a place they could stay real close, and they had to either walk or have some way of transportation to get to this little school.
Oh, did they have, they had all the grades in one room with just one teacher?
Up to the seventh grade.
And they had a piano, though, didn't they, out here?
I don't remember.
Seems like I remember an old
piano. Well, it might have been an organ. I don't know whether it's piano or an organ, but it seemed to me like, I guess it was an old organ there because they had dances in this school.
Well, when they had the, didn't they have community get-togethers?
Oh, yeah, in the school.
There,
yeah.
And people would
They'd
come.
Have community dances, and people from all over the country came, big crowds.
And they'd spend the night, camp out
camp
on the school.
Camp out in wagons. They'd come in wagons. It'd take them 3 or 4 hours to get from Crystal Springs out here in a wagon, and Crystal City to come in a wagon, but they'd come prepared to stay all night. They didn't intend to go back during the night.
To Comanche, were there any telephones out here?
Oh, yeah, there was one party line that must have had 40 people on it, just one line.
How well did that work?
It didn't work too good because there was too many people on it. They were on it all the time. That's the only way they had to visit, unless they went in a wagon or a horseback or in a buggy to see one another. So they just get on the phone. A bunch of women get on the phone. They'd sit there and talk all day if you didn't get them off.
Was there any kind of community store out here or anything?
Comanche, there was a little
there
community
was?
Store.
What'd they sell?
Well, just what people eat. Beans, mostly beans, potatoes, and sugar, and coffee, and lard.
Was this bought out of barrels or individually or what?
In barrels.
They would sack it up for you?
The beans come in sacks. Sugar came in sacks, big 100-pound bags. All your lard came in barrels.
Do you remember the prices on any of this stuff?
Well, not necessarily. It wasn't very much, I don't think. Anything you got, mostly vinegar came in barrels. You take your jar and go to the store and buy your vinegar, and you get a gallon or a quart. Well, you wanted, it came in 50-gallon barrels.
Take your own jar.
Take your own jar.
Were there ever any bad storms out here at that time?
I don't remember any at that time.
What kind of refrigeration did you have back in the 1920s in Comanche?
The only refrigeration we had a hole dug in the ground. And we had it walled up with lumber, then we put galvanized sheet on inside of that and made a real heavy lid out of about 2x6s and lined that with, if we could get some cork, we lined it with cork. And we went to town on a weekend, we'd buy a big slab of ice and we'd put it down in this box, this hole. And it would generally last a week in there. And that's the only refrigeration we had.
Did you keep your milk and everything on ice then, or you just drank
had water? Had a little cooler. Had a rag hanging over it. You poured water on the top of it. And this rag would siphon this water down over this old cooling deal. It was wrapped around a few legs and things. It would siphon down, the wind blowing through it, kept your milk cool, and it probably wouldn't sour for 2 days. Your butter would stay. Wouldn't melt. It would stay soft, but it wouldn't get hard like it would in the refrigerator, but it didn't melt down and run all over it.
Of course, your milk in those days would clabber, and you ate that too.
We'd clabber it, and then made butter, and churned it, and made butter out of it. The joke that they used to tell about people that couldn't understand Spanish, they'd go to Mexico, and they'd be standing around, and an old man went into Mexico, and he'd stand around on the corner over there, and he didn't Mexicans going along the streets, you know, and they were jabbering and jabbering and jabbering, and most of the words he could pick up that he didn't know too much was Kensavi and Crocosee. And he'd Mexican to go by, and they'd be talking. One say Kensavi and the other say Crocosee. And he just couldn't. It seemed like everything he said was Kensavi and Crocosee. So he was standing on the corner there one morning, and he Mexican came by in a funeral services. And they were going down the road, and this had these wagons and had this casket and everything on this wagon. And a Mexican come by, and he says to this Mexican, he says, who died? Mexican said, Kensavi. He said, well, mister, said, I hope to hell Crocosee dies too, and y'all have somebody else to talk about. Said, that's all I can hear is Kensavi and Crocosee.
I had a rather interesting guard in a pump house one time out here at Cometa. What was it?
It was a bull snake, a big black bull snake. And he was raised as a pet in this pump house, and we always went out and kill rats for him and bring them in, and he'd come up to you. He was real large, about, I guess, 6 foot, maybe 7 foot long, a big black snake. And he stayed in this pump house because we run this engine in the wintertime, and it kept this shed really warm in there. And he stayed right in this little area. I never seen him wait in that area. He stayed right there. And we'd go out and kill wood rats and things and bring them in there and give them to him. He'd come to meet you just like anything else that you fed. And one morning we was fixed to cut spinach there, and it was pretty cool, and these Mexicans came out from town, and the contractors brought their hands out to cut the spinach. And it's a little cool, so they go in this pump house. Well, they go in there to kind of get warm, and this snake comes crawling to them, you know, to figure they're going to feed him something, and they kill him. And I go down there and find this snake dead, and if I'd have had a gun, I might have killed me some Mexicans. I don't know. I was so mad I didn't know what to do about it. They'd kill my mascot and thought they'd done a big favor by killing him.
Well, and all the time he was in there, you all didn't have to worry about rattlesnakes.
No, rattlesnakes. He didn't have to worry about rattlesnakes at all. They keep all the rattlesnakes run away. They kill them and eat them, and I guess they eat them. I don't know, but I caught one time. It's drawed up to a limb, and we saw him from the road. He was about, I guess, 30 feet from the road, and this old big snake was just had his head right up against this limb. And we stopped and went out there. Put him there. Harold Harkey was with us, and the car belonged to him, and we stopped, and we go out there and get this, to see what the snake deal is. He just had his head right up against this limb. We backed up, went out there and looked at him, and he had swatted a rattlesnake. And this rattlesnake had his tail wrapped around his limb, and he wouldn't turn loose, and the snake just sitting there holding him. But we unwrap his tail, and he swatted it, and we get the snake, and we put him in his car. This car belonged to his daddy, the real big black snake. We put this snake in this old man's car. He was county attorney here, so we put this snake in his car. And we get to town, this old snake has crawled back up in the upholstery. We can't find him. We looked the whole car. We couldn't find the snake no place. So we didn't tell his daddy the snake was in the car. So the next morning, his daddy gets up, and he goes out to get in his car. And there that big snake caught up in the seat, just laying there. Well, he makes a break to get something to kill the snake with, but when he gets back, the snake's gone. So he takes the car right straight back to the garage. It's about a week old, and he trades it for another automobile. He gets rid of that car because that snake's in the upholstery, and he don't tell the people he traded with that the snake's in there either. And we didn't tell him. We put him in there.
Know any other snake stories?
Rattlesnakes. I've killed, I don't know how many rattlesnakes I've killed in my life. Lots of people are afraid of them, but I haven't had any reason to be afraid of him. I guess one ever bites me, well, I'll be afraid of him. If I can't find a stick and he looks like he's going to get away, I'll just stomp him.
You're not afraid to step up and just stomp him?
No, as long as he's running, if he's crawling in the grass, well, there's no danger. He can't strike you as long as he's crawling. He's got to be coiled up to strike you. Next door, some people put a rattlesnake in a telephone booth in the Crooked City years ago and coiled him up in his telephone booth and laid him in there. He was dead. And this man had always came there to this place to make telephone calls. The man's dead now. His name was Mark Coleman. He came in there and always used this telephone booth. And he goes in this telephone booth, and when he closed the door, the light comes on. And he looks down, and here's this big rattlesnake caught up right under his feet, you know, in there. And he don't wait to open the door. He just makes the door. And he went home, got his gun, and he was going to kill the person. He put it in there if he could find out who did it, but nobody didn't tell him. He was pretty well stirred up. But then, reading why he was so shy of rattlesnakes, he was sitting down one day where they'd been hauling hay, and he had a can of Prince Albert tobacco in his back pocket. And he squatted down there, and it was kind of cool, and they were sitting down there, and this rattlesnake reached up out of this hay where the shock was It stuck, grabbed him right where this can was. Well, it just hung in his pants, hung his fangs in his pants, and the thing didn't come loose. So he gets up and he just goes to dancing in a circle, and that rattlesnake hanging on him, round and around. And everybody was working with him. It's about 6-7 people working with him. They all got tickled and got to laughing, and one of them hollered out, "Stay with him!" And said, directly, kept going in such a circle there, dancing, just like an Indian war dance. And he just, finally, old snake, I guess, pulled his fangs out or something. He come loose anyhow and rolled off out there, and all these people just dying of laughing. And just as soon as he could get his breath, he looked up and he told them. He said, "Well, anybody thinks that's funny, I just don't give a damn whether I work with you anymore, because I don't think it's funny." So he quit.
Speaking of Indians, did you know any Indians at all?
I knew one.
One Indian is all?
Yeah, that I thought that was probably a real Indian. He came to our house, and we was just small kids, about 1913. And he camped, had a tent, and we let him stay and camp out in the back part of our yard in Crystal City. And we questioned him, and we talked to him, just small kids. And we talked to him, and my daddy talked to him about the method they used to make these Indian arrowheads, how they made them. And he said, as far as he knew, back as far as he could remember, his grandfolks or his grandparents, none of them knew how to make Indian arrowheads. And he didn't know how they made them.
The rock.
But somebody made them.
The rock arrowheads.
Yeah, the rock arrowheads made out of flint rock, yeah.
Than he could remember.
He just couldn't remember the day that then his grandparents couldn't tell him how they were made.
Well, did he mention remembering how to make the metal arrowheads?
Well, they were metal arrowheads. The white people made the metal ones, and they traded them to the Indians for the rock ones to start with. But as far as the Indian arrowhead deal is, I don't think anybody knows exactly what they use or how they made them. Some people tell you they can make them, but I've got to see it.
This is the end of the interview.